there's a chair here still, and there's still a little more standing room. Well, I think we have our bulk in here right now, so. Good evening, everybody. My name is Jillian Morrissey. I'm one of your neighbors. I live up on off of Murphy Road here. And I'm going to be facilitating tonight's meeting just so that it can go smoothly and that we can get people's voices out there. And yeah, so if you hear my voice, that might be because I'm asking just for people to speak one at a time or things like that. So if you hear my voice, try to listen up throughout the night. And this is my son, Rowan, who's speaking. The reason for our meeting tonight, just to catch folks up on what's going on, as you all know, if you maybe got a flyer in the mail, or maybe you've been paying attention to the news, or maybe you've just been coming to community council meetings, Usabelli is starting development this summer, and from what we've heard at the March 11th meeting in Sutton, is that there's going to be a pioneer road going in, and they're going to be doing some sampling and some other surveying. And since our neighborhood is pretty darn close to where the proposed mine is, we wanted to get more information, learn more. So we invited Usabelli to come up to Buffalo Soapstone for tonight, for April 5th, and that was a tentative meeting, and then they actually ended up declining. So because there is still an interest in getting more information, we knew it was important to connect with our agencies that we work, that are going to be the regulatory agencies that work with the permitting company, with Usabelli, and find out more about this permit, find out more about what's happening. Let's see.
So there's no Usabelli?
No Usabelli tonight.
If we can interrupt this minute, it's not the news.
The property supposedly has 14 million tons of coal, but some residents say extracting that could have a devastating effect. We know firsthand the effects of it. This is bed and breakfast just outside of Paul. Our responding delegates are visited by all sorts of guests, with the neighbors gone. He comes and gets his food every morning, then moved here in the early 90s, looking for peace and quiet. Well, it's just a little piece of heaven, but now they worry that could be jeopardized. If so far, it's less than a mile from where we're at here. This summer, Usabelli Coal Mine, which is headquartered in Healy, plans to take steps toward creating a full-scale coal mine at Wishbone Hill.
It'll be coming up, and they've got all of this area right here.
Usabelli leased 8,100 acres in this area in hopes of tapping into an estimated 14 million tons of coal. The company received a permit to mine here in 1992. Since then, a growing number of residents have moved in.
Good. A coal mine near a residential area, if we had our choice, but the coal is where it is, and we have no choice but to mine it there or not at all.
But the Zirkles and some of their neighbors worry the mine will contaminate nearby Moose Creek and cause serious health effects because the prevailing winds could expose everyone in the Matsu to hazardous coal dust. It's going to be in the air. There's no way we can stop it. Loading the truck, digging, blasting, it has to go in the air. The company says it understands why people are concerned, but promises if it mines here, it will do what it can to minimize the impacts.
There are regulations we have to follow relating to all of those things that are designed to protect people that are in the vicinity or both people and general environmental resources.
But the Zirkles are not convinced and don't plan to sit back and stay silent about their concerns. All we can do is try and get the word out to people. Because they say there is too much to lose if the mine changes the pristine beauty in this part of the Matsu Borough.
A public informational meeting on this topic is unscheduled.
That's a pretty good intro. Wow.
That doesn't happen that often.
What a time.
So just because there's a lot of emotion around this issue for people, since this is an issue that's close to home, why they're for it or against it. When we have meetings like this, it's important to establish just a few ground rules just so that we have that as a common understanding. I would ask that we can use one voice at a time in here, just so that we can hear everybody. We're packed in pretty tight here, and it might be difficult to hear folks in the back, so I might ask you to speak up if folks can't hear you. I'd ask also that we try to keep, if we can keep comments brief or questions brief, that would be wonderful, so that we can try to get to everybody's comments in here. We have a lot of people in the room tonight. But please also get out your statement or your question that you need to ask. Also, if we can try to keep from side conversations, that's really distracting, and this is our opportunity to meet with our guests tonight, so it's really important that everyone has a chance to hear what they have to say. And then lastly, if always, I think I like adding this, let's just keep it neighborly. Keep it neighborly amongst ourselves, and also these are our guests who are making time for us to help educate ourselves about what's going on with the proposed mine, so also keeping it neighborly for these folks. So with that, I think what we're going to end up doing tonight, just as a framework so people know, we're going to have DNR do a presentation on an overview of the permit and some other major topics. And then we also have Matt LaCroix from the EPA here, and they'll be speaking from an agency regulation point of view. And then we'll do questions and answer time after their DNR's presentation. So that's how we'll run tonight. Are there any questions about that? Okay, well, with that, I'd like to introduce Russell Kirkham from DNR. He is the coal program manager. And we also have Rick Fredrickson, who is the
mining section chief.
Mining section chief. And so these guys have come all the way from Anchorage to be here tonight. So I hand it over to you guys first.
Okay.
Thanks, you guys.
Well, thank you so much for having me out here. It's not really set up for a PowerPoint presentation. I'm just going to run this off the cuff. I'll be very informal. If I'm not clear, please stop, ask a question, interrupt me. I'd like to take a chance to just talk about the SMACRA program first. This is the Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act, where it came from historically in the United States. Talk a little bit about the permitting process, just a really brief overview. Talk about surface coal mining operations, and then I'll talk about basically inspections and some permitting procedures for the mine site. So, and then go a little bit about the Wishbone Hill project, and then talk a little about how you can get involved either through the public process or through other actions you can take to help the states on different issues. So, the Surface Mining Control Reclamation Act came about in the 1970s due to issues back in the Appalachian regions through coal country back there. Major environmental disturbances. In 1977, Congress enacted this program, and they created a federal office under the Department of Interior charged with controlling all aspects of coal mining, from exploration to development, actual operations, reclamation, includes bonding, inspection, enforcement. Everything was tied into this program. This act also created an abandoned mines program that allowed you to basically allow some of the past abuses that were abandoned to come and be cleaned up. So an example would be the strip pits behind Wishbone Hill. A lot of those have been reclaimed under the abandoned mine land program. Other parts of the country, it takes care of acid mine drainage locations. Abandoned mine program also covers closes shafts, other high wall features, etc.
And in fact, our abandoned mine lands program has been pretty active down in the Jonesville area for the last several years, doing reclamation work over there.
What year was it that you enacted?
1977.
I have a question on that. Who paid for that?
The AML program comes out, every ton of coal is taxed at 32 cents a ton nationwide, and that goes back into the AML program. Alaska doesn't produce that much coal, but we're a minimum program state. Currently, we get about $3 million a year to do AML work in the state. Other states have had longer history, larger production. They get $10 to $15, $20, $30 million a year. The next part of the program, the regulatory portion, allows for states to take primacy from the federal government. In 1985, the state of Alaska took primacy over the federal, basically took primacy of SMACRA from the federal government. So we've been in charge of implementing this program ever since. And so,
that 32 cents a ton for a ton of coal, is it was established at this time? At the, in
it was 1977? Established in 1977.
So that's a current rate today, too, also?
That's the current rate.
Is that enough money to reclaim these areas?
For abandoned mine, it's too much money right now. A lot of states have completed their work. Wyoming is one state. Once you complete all the reclamation on your site, you become a certified state. All that money is now excess, and the states can start using it for other purposes. So,
other than coal restoration?
They can do reclamation. Basically, it's abandoned mine land reclamation. This is completely separate from the regulatory process. Okay, the regulatory process, I'll go into in detail here in a second, but it's just abandoned areas that were either in the 50s, 40s, there's areas in the state, it was abandoned back in the 20s, where it's an old mine shaft going into the side of a hill, but it's still an abandoned mine area.
Yeah, abandoned mine lands program primarily focuses on disturbances that are like pre-1976 or thereabouts.
Yeah.
Anything since then, the abandoned mine lands program doesn't usually work on.
What does it mean when reclamation is complete? Did you just make it safe so people aren't falling down mine shafts?
For abandoned mine lands, the question was, what does abandoned mine lands use, the abandoned mine land program use as a term for reclamation? The abandoned mine land program, their primary focus is safety. Their issue is high wall elimination, shaft closures, some environmental issues, acid mine drainage in places, but that's the main focus for is safety. The regulatory side, which I'm working on, our focus is site closure for reclamation. It looks at what is the post-mining land use. So reclamation is whatever the land use here. So in the moose range, that would be wildlife, moose habitat. So the land has to go back to that use.
Is there a concept?
I was just going to say, but he has a presentation, so let's is that right?
It's okay.
Are you okay with that?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't have a projector. It's a little bit hard to talk.
We're not trying to be hard to get along with. Is what's currently at the Jonesville mine right now that has been reclaimed, is that what?
That's all pre-law. That's 1977 before activities. That was the fires out there. It was the high walls in the back. That's what AML's worked on.
Right. But my question is what's there right now what you consider reclaimed?
From my side, no. Okay. From the regulatory side, that's not reclamation. That is fixing a safety problem.
Right.
So.
Thank you.
So, as I said in the very beginning, the SMACRA permit for the regulatory side focuses on all aspects of mining. When I have a company come talk to me about wanting to look at coal, what I tell them is that if you think about coal in Alaska, if it's on state land or private land, you need to come to the state and talk to us. To go explore for coal, you need a permit from the state. To mine from coal, you need to get a permit from the state. We cover just the operational plans, blasting plans for the state. That's the wrong side. Forgive me, I'm trying to do a presentation without slides. So the essential elements of the regulatory program. As I said, exploration and baseline studies. Basically, there's a permitting system in place that gives expectations to you, the neighbors, to the company, to the regulatory authority, so that we know what to expect from a company. There are performance standards within the law that spells out how do they design for closure. What does a post-mining channel look like? How are backfill spoils taken care of? If there are toxic and acid-conforming material on site, how is this contained? Those are some of the performance standards that have to be addressed in the permitting system. On top of that, the company is required to design the permit for reclamation. So everything they do is focused on putting the land back in, back together. And to that end, they're required to post a bond that is worst case scenario on the site. So what is the maximum disturbance possible at the site from the operational plan? They have to post a bond equal to that amount. So this is for a third party to come in and do all the work. And then on top of that, as a state agency, we're required to be on site monthly for inspections. And we have fining and the power to stop the mine. We can issue a cessation order and stop the mine on the spot. Yes?
How high is the bond on that, let's say, for runoff ponds when they build it up to wash it up in the earthquake area? Yeah.
The bond here.
How high is it?
The highest bond gets up to $34
million. $34 million. And how is it decided?
I'll go into that in a bit. Okay.
Is that a third party other than the company who mined the coal? That's or are a they considered the third party?
Third party other than the company. What the technique we use is that we imagine that the company disappears, all their equipment no longer exists. It means we have to contract out to bring equipment in. We have to contract out to do all the earth moving, remove all the buildings. If they left all their equipment, disposing all the equipment, taking everything on site, putting the topsoil back in, seeding it, taking it through the normal regulatory bond release process.
And that's the worst case scenario of the bond, or is that just the normal process after the company?
That's worst case scenario for the bond. That's the amount of money we bring in. Just add on to that, when we do bonding, we review the bond every 2 years, 2.5 years, or every time the market changes, we will relook at the bond. So last couple of years, we had a spike in all the prices. We pulled out every bond in the state, we started looking at them again.
So what you're saying is if they don't go in and do their job and reclaim the land and plant the seeds, that bond will cover somebody else coming in and doing it for them?
Yes.
Okay.
And the bond's only for reclamation?
Bonds for reclamation.
I was going to say, who might determine the price of the stream being polluted and, you know, killing the salmon?
Well, that's...
That sort of thing. How does that figure into...
Well, that's, you can't bond for something that is illegal in the first place. If they're discharging water that's put in the stream, we would stop them before that. And then we also have civil penalties that we can take. If the company was doing this normally, we can go out to them individually for full cost.
Who does the testing of water? You know, I went to the Usabelli website in Hilly, and their laboratory is doing a testing for pollution or the water, and how's that independent from?
Well, that's the company does its internal water quality standards. They test the water at all the ponds. The company also hires the USGS to do water quality samples, and they hire the state water quality section, and they do.
So a company does that?
An outside company does it.
No, I mean, it's done by the company, and it's done by some agencies as well.
Because
but the routine sampling is done by the company and reported to the agency.
According to Usabelli website, they're doing their laboratory, their workers, their employees doing the
day-to-day
testing.
Sampling is done by the company.
Okay.
They do annual compliance testing outside by an outside contractor. So last thing I talked about, monthly inspections on all active mining and exploration sites. So while if they come out this summer to do exploration work, my inspectors will be out monthly working on them. On top of this, we can do criminal and civil penalties against the operator if they knowingly violate the law. This is a very strong way to get assurance from the company. So before a permit can get issued, the company has to go out and collect baseline data for the site. This data can go from cultural resources, basically superficial geology, underground geology, surface and groundwater quality, groundwater quantity, so how much water, what's the water like on the site, pre-disturbance. They have to study what's the weather pattern on the site. They have to study regional air quality. They have to model that. They have to do vegetation surveys on the site, fish and wildlife surveys. They do soil and wetlands. Then they do research on the land use of the area. All this is done either by the company But most companies hire outside contractors like HDR or ABR, one of the large consulting firms, to do the work for them with specialists. This information is compiled. They work with the state to develop basically study plans. Once they have all this information, then they can submit a permit.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yes, ma'am.
Is Sebelli's current permit, was all this data gathered way back in the 80s then?
Some of the data was kind of the 80s, some of the data was gathered in the 90s, and UC Sebelli has been out for the last 3 years gathering additional data.
So you're saying these permits, these studies are done or not done?
They are done. They've been ongoing. They had the initial geology study. Geology doesn't change. Water quality doesn't change. They've gone back out, looked at, did fish studies on site. They're doing new air monitoring studies on site.
So water quality, actually, the standards can change.
Okay? Standards can change, but what's there, if there's no real disturbance on site, geology doesn't change for a stream or an area.
Is that public information?
Yes.
And where can we find it?
I'm going to have, so basically it's in our office. I'm going to actually modify the website and put it all on the web for you guys to look at.
So Russell, how are you tracking water quantity in the area?
Well, the stream, they do gauging.
Are they tracking like groundwater?
They have monitoring wells on site.
Right, I know that because my husband took the data from that. Are they still collecting that data?
They went out and did a second round of groundwater sampling. Was it last summer?
When you say they went out and collected the data and then applied for the permit, do they also come at the same time and say, this is what we're planning to do at our mine site, we need this much water to do this, this is what we have out there, this is how we're going to mine? Or is it just, this is what's out there, we want to mine?
They have to, when they apply for the permit, they have to tell me baseline, how they plan to mine, how they plan to reclaim, what they plan to bond up front.
Okay, because when I've asked UC Sebelli where they're going to get their water from for this upcoming mine, they don't know. So I don't know how that got through the mining process. I guess I'd like to see the permit and see where they said before, because the guys I asked now don't know. That's all.
Well,
do you know?
Well, the question is where they're getting the water from. They're producing a lot of water on site. They have to dewater the gravels out there. You have to dewater the coal seams. So that's on site water. Now, if they need additional water.
Can take it from the creek?
Well, they're not supposed to be in Moose Creek.
They said they wouldn't touch Moose Creek, but they said they would touch, or they want to hopefully touch Buffalo Creek, is what they're calling it, the drainage out of Wishbone Lake. That goes in the creek, but it pretty much runs dry most of the year. It's kind of silly that they're like, oh, we're going to take our water from there. So they haven't really had a solid answer to me of where they're going to get the water for washing a lot of this coal. And yes, they do have water from the site they can use, but they didn't think it was enough, or they didn't know. But I just want to know how that affected DNR's permitting of the thing, because if they don't know how they're going to do it.
Well, off the top of my head, I can go back and look at the permit, see what it says about water for washing. This has been a
that'd be good.
Background.
Thanks.
Yes.
These bonds that are in the permitting process, are any part of those bonds covering personal property damage, or is it just bonds for reclaiming?
And I'll segue into that about other things affecting personal property.
Okay.
Hey, Russell, regarding the water, doesn't a mining operation typically recycle the bulk of their water during the operation?
That is typical for most sites, is to recycle a lot of their water.
How do they do that?
You have a closed pond, you just let it settle out and take more water out of it. So just skim the top of the water out and take it back for operation. So.
Do they filter it somehow? Because actually, if it's recycled, they're going to be dirty again.
Well, it depends on the amount of filtering they need is based on what their use is.
I have a question. I'm a little stupid. Why do they water the coal, and why do they wash it?
That's a fair question.
That's a fair question. The coal in this area has lots of ash particles. Ash particles and other impurities in it. It's like ash, bone coal, which is like carb shale, something like that. They wash it to remove that fraction out. Pretty much, that's uneconomical, you can't burn it. They don't want to ship stuff they don't need off-site.
And what happens to all of that?
That goes back into the pit and gets couple of, yeah.
You go back and just bury one of the pits filled up.
So are those toxic chemicals that you're washing off of it?
It's cold, it's already there.
It's already toxic.
It's already.
Yeah, but you're bringing it to the surface.
How will that affect our local wells? If they decide to, they don't have enough water, they decide to put wells in and take from the aquifers that are flowing in this area, mm-hmm. and they start sucking a tremendous amount of water out, our wells start perhaps drying up, or what's the possibility of that happening to us?
Well, that depends on the regional hydrology. Mm-hmm. They're on the other side of Moose Creek, they're in the bedrock of Moose Creek. The connection between this side of Moose Creek, either the alluvium that some of the wells are here, the alluvial wells that your water is coming out lower in the valley here, there's really no connection between what's in the site. But that being said, they're required to monitor their discharge around the site. So if they're overdrawing water that has an effect, they have to monitor, instead of monitoring that hookup, so they would know if there is potential change.
If there is potential change, legally who has rights to the water, the mine or the business?
I'll get to that in a second. Okay.
Is there a place where we could access information about hydrology in this area?
It's going to be on the website in a couple of days, as soon as I can get it set up in the
permit. Your section?
The coal section. I have the address for the coal web page, state coal web page. It'll be linked to that page in a couple of days. Okay.
There's a lot of documents. A lot of them are going to be books, big documents. So we're going to try to break them up so you can download sections that you want. Otherwise, it'll take forever to download.
Yeah, especially some of us have dial-up up here.
Exactly. We'll try to break them up so you can get them easily.
That'd be great.
Well, the document itself was 4 gigs of information, and that's our CIC people, our internet control people, get very upset when I want the 4 gig document on the server. So I need to break it up and get something that's usable to you.
It's so, a bookcase full, isn't it?
Yes. So we're going to segue into what does the law say about protecting your environment? The main concern here is water and blasting effects.
And noise
and air. Noise and air are outside my permitting. Air is controlled by DEC Air. They'll have the hook for that control. Noise is usually done by borough noise ordinances. For me, I don't have any regulatory framework to change how they operate for noise. But for blasting, as I said earlier, we have requirements for inspections. Monthly inspections are all set. At least 4 of those inspections a year are complete inspections. That's when the inspector is on site looking at every component of the site. In addition, the inspections are required to do citizens' complaints. So if you guys observe something where they're discharging water, we're required to investigate that complaint. If there's something on site that you believe is going wrong, or you have information that you believe that there's a problem, you can request a citizen inspection. We'll be out within 24 hours, maybe sooner, depending on the severity of the issue.
So will we be allowed on site?
That's the next part. For citizen inspections, the person who issues the complaint is allowed to accompany the inspector on that complaint, portion of the complaint.
How do you get on site? You
got to get on site first.
Well, it's if you see something discharging off.
They're not going to let me walk down the road to go see what they're doing today. They're getting in the woods and they can do whatever they want. I'm not going to walk over there and walk down the road and say, hey.
But you will see any kind of discharge flowing into Moose Creek, or if you see fly rock coming off, or blasting complaints.
How is this blasting going to affect our septics and our wells?
Well, I'm getting to blasting and information about blasting. So I talked about we're required to inspect. We have an opportunity. We're out here as much as possible. You guys have the ability that if you see something going wrong on site, you can call us out, take a look at it. Our hooks to make sure they comply is that we can issue a series of fines and violations. We can issue a notice of violation, which is a very expensive speeding ticket against the company, where we can charge up to $5,000 a day per incident.
That's expensive?
Well, it adds up. This is this is the lowest bar. Mm-hmm. The next bar up is a cessation order, where we can shut down the entire operation on top of the fine. That's where the price starts getting expensive for the company.
Russell, can I ask a quick question? Has that ever happened?
We've issued cessation orders against Jonesville. We've issued violations against Usability and Healy.
Okay.
You've issued citations against Usability?
Yes.
So it's a really clean company, does have a dirty record.
Everyone gets a violation.
Yeah, so they've told them, basically.
They told them, the community, that they've had zero citations. Zero.
On records, what they told us.
Is that on your website?
No, it's on the annual report. From.
Can you put it on your website and put that other stuff up there? How their citations, the history you have with Usability violating.
Well, I can show you where you can get the citation history.
The record?
Yeah. They're a very good record. They get one or two violations every couple of years.
That doesn't sound good.
That is, by and large, a pretty good record.
What's average for not necessarily Usability, but another mining company, say, in Alaska? What's the average number of violations in a year?
It's you're comparing apples and oranges. The coal program can is the only program that actually issues violations and does monetary fines against the company. Usability, one, maybe two, every 3 or 4 years. When Jonesville was going on, it would at least one or two a year would be issued against the company. In the lower 48, you go back to some mines in Virginia, they get 15 or 20 per inspection. So
inspection, once a month?
Once a month.
Okay, it's going on all the time.
What's going on all the time?
Okay. Those are the horrors.
Hey, we got to keep it one at a time, folks.
So, yes, ma'am.
Oh, how are your inspections set up? Are they scheduled with the company, or are they surprise?
We do a combination of we let them know we're coming to we show up at the doorstep and we're here. Sometimes we get a 24-hour notice that we're going to be on site. Sometimes no notice at all.
Do they let you in?
They are required to let us on site. We are, by state statute, allowed to enter any permit area on private or public land, Native Corporation land, without a warrant. We can't enter into a private building, but the site itself, we have full access to.
That's really specific because it's in a residential background and it's a strip mine, so it's totally, like you said, comparing apples to oranges with even fines and citations will be totally different over here. You agree with that, right?
There'll be differences here. Okay. There'll be more inspections, more complaints, and we would be out here addressing them.
And luckily we're closer.
Does it take place just during business hours, or would you be coming in the middle of the night? And the reason I ask is because I've been on mines before where they let the settling pond go at night. And they have it figured out so that the stream will clear up by the time it gets dark in August.
And that is something that we may not be there at night if that's happened. I've read the case law, and people have gone to jail for that and lost everything. And this is the president who's gone to jail. There's been a couple in the Midwest where the company did the same thing, and they timed releasing of sediment to make sure the ponds were always empty for the day shift, and they went to jail. So.
But to answer your question, we typically do not.
Yeah. I've been at mine sites at night, but this is for different issues. I was working on a reclamation issue, and I was meeting with the operators, so I went on the night shifts. I do that at least once a summer where I meet with the operators at night to talk to people at night since they do most of the on-site reclamation and regrade work.
Of course, at 9 p.m. in the summer, it's not too dark.
But won't they be mining all year long?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, so it's going to be night.
Yeah, 6 months worth.
Yes.
Do you offhand know if their violations were water violations or?
the two violations issued this past year. One was a embankment that was supposed to keep some material from spilling over the site. The dozer operator pushed it down and pushed the material over off the site, so it left the disturbance area that was still on the permit. They got a violation for that. The other violation was issued because they improperly did their warning. Instead of using a siren like they were supposed to, they did it all over the radio. And they received a violation.
That was
a
have they ever received a water violation?
They've received water violations from EPA. They're actually, I think, in court right now for one.
So right now, the borough had several maps out that show trail systems throughout the Methodist area that we can use. And all those trails are listed as public use.
Yes.
Right now. Do we lose access to those public use?
If the site would go through, the trails would be rerouted during mine life. I was saying if the project went forward, the trails would have to be rerouted for the life of the mine and then put back in afterwards.
To answer that a little further, it's only the ADL listed trails. There's a lot of trails out there in that area. There's only one ADL trail that's been listed, and that goes from right here pretty much straight over to Jonesville. All the other ones, Yusuf Billy said they don't care about them, they're going to be gone. That's what they said.
There's another question. Could you?
She asked the question.
Okay. So I ended off on show cause orders. Show cause orders are pretty much, it's the next step of a cessation order. Show cause order pretty much says, you need to show me why I'm not taking away this permit. And basically taking your bond also. I said talk about fines, and then criminal penalties and civil penalties. On top of this, if you receive a violation and it's outstanding, you cannot get any other permit in the country, coal mine permit in the country. So any violation they do here would severely affect operations elsewhere in the state and vice versa.
You're talking about the violators list?
Yeah.
How come their violations in Healy don't affect their ability to have this mine?
Well, the violations were solved. They corrected the problem.
Paid the fine. He did one in court?
That's a water violation. That's an EPA water violation not under my program. EPA has a different permitting mechanism and finding mechanism. So.
Mr. LaCroix will be talking about that.
I can provide some information.
You want to add now or you want to?
No, I can be.
Okay.
It's under a different statute. So they are distinct.
I've missed some of that. You said that they're currently monitoring the water?
They've been out there doing water monitoring, yes.
They're just walking through occasionally?
Well, they're doing updates to their permits.
See, you're familiar with Beluga Coal Mine and Pack Rim Coal, mm-hmm. and Machuca. Well, I worked for 13 years as a subcontractor doing all the water quality. Mm-hmm. And we monitor water over there for that coal mine every minute of the day. There are electronic monitoring systems in the Chute River, Lone Creek, Middle Creek, various other creeks that are on that permit area. Basically, I would go over once a month and download all that data. I would do water samples. Is that what usability has done here?
No.
Okay, so they're not really doing a bang-up water quality.
They've met the requirement for a lot of collect water quality for okay. DEC at the time. So. And as I said, this is the DEC permit is still looking at, DEC is still looking at the permit. Okay. They mainly collect more surface water quality data to meet that requirement. Okay. So let's move on. The next stop, we talked about blasting. Okay, big concern. Usability is required that, let me step slower. Anyone within a half mile of the permit boundary may request from the state or from the operator, a pre-blast survey of your property. This includes foundations, water wells, everything. It basically takes a snapshot of your property at that time. This is a certified report that's submitted to the state and to the homeowner.
It's half a mile away from
half a mile. That's what the state law said, from the permit boundary. So the permit boundary is this line, this gray line right here. So half mile from there, anyone with merit can request a pre-blast survey.
Who do you request this to?
You write the DNR, and then before the mine can operate, they have to do the survey.
If your basements are finished off and stuff like that, how can they possibly?
They come to your house and you'd like to do a survey of your house.
Yeah.
And it's up to you to let them in.
Sure, but if your basements are finished off, how do you properly
inspect if they're cracked?
Inspect if there's flaws in the wall.
You have to hire a professional inspector to do that kind of survey with.
But would you have to tear the walls down in order to see the cement?
I'm not a surveyor, I don't know.
Are you aware how big of the charges they're using for blasting?
This permit has not had a blast plan set up for it.
Who would have that information?
It's not available yet. It's still, it's required 30 days before the permit goes active. Before they start blasting, they have to submit to DNR their plan.
So
until
3 days before?
30 days.
30. So, where did he come up with a half mile?
That's what's in law.
That's what's in the law, but is that really, I mean.
From, this, that's just half mile. There's other parts of the regulation, the law that says that the amount of explosives you're allowed to use is based on a scale distance factor, which says that for a certain distance from the mine, you're allowed to use a maximum amount of explosives per 8 milliseconds. That's done by engineers across the country looking at, from the effects we've seen in other places, this is what maximizes the protection to the per people's site.
How old those regulations are?
Because these regulations get updated very regularly.
Because we're talking about mining in the residential area here.
Well, these were designed for the Appalachian regions where people are within quarter mile, where they're much less to the location. That's why I talk about scale distance, where if you're really close to someone's house.
There's a structure of housing.
Yeah, the amount of explosive you can use within that distance will be greatly reduced.
The intent is the law that there is to be no damage to your structure.
Yeah. It's a very conservative estimate. Give you an example, not a good example here, but Ysabelli and Healy has no one nearby. They do a lot of cash outs. Cash outs is where they take the earth and they just move it with explosives.
Mm-hmm.
They can use 100,000 pounds of explosives to move something. But the nearest person is 5 miles away. You can't hear it from town.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I lived out the Stampede Road. You can hear it. I live 20 miles from there. You can hear it.
Wow.
Okay.
Who do you request that from the surveys?
The surveys? You would request that from the state.
And that, I was just going to ask, who are the inspectors? Is it a private firm?
It would have to be a private contractor.
Okay, and that's paid for through a...
You said you were required to pay for it.
Okay, and but the residents could choose their own...
They would hire a contractor
okay.
who certified them.
Ysabelli would just supply a... We could hire our own...
No, but Ysabelli would have to supply the contractor.
Mm-hmm.
Does that also include, let's say, because everybody mentioned here, our wells are really sensitive and putting out a little bit of water, and every shake we have or tremor, there's no water and the silt is pumped up by the pumps.
Right.
I mean, if we're so close, is that the permitting saying anything about wells?
It does. That's why it says that for blasting, it includes your well.
Well, also.
Okay. Water is another important issue. If blasting affects your water, or if the mining affects your water, the company is by law required to replace your water supply. Mm-hmm. If that's pumping city water in from Palmer or Anchorage, that's their coast. That's the closest city water supply. Or they can drill your new well. Okay? That's the requirement.
Do you suggest we get any types of water rates or anything like that to prove the flowage that our wells have or the quality that our water
has? I would get a pump test in your well. If they do test your well, I would test it, see how much water was there, what's the existing use of your water, because they cannot diminish your water. If you got 10 gallons a minute of fresh water, you can't have any less.
How recent does that have to be?
Mm-hmm. Usually they'll come in right before.
Right
before. Yeah.
And who pays for that?
The pre-blast survey would be paid for by the company.
Okay.
The people will be reimbursed if they spend their own money?
No, they, you'd have to go through the company to get this done.
Okay.
Or through the state. Sorry, I'm getting over a cold. My throat's going fast. So.
Would they go by the, when you very first got your wells and you have your flow test and everything, would they go by that?
Or you can use that one? Or you can have them do a new one.
Okay. Thank you.
Ample, go ahead.
If we have a third-party test or a well for quality or quantity, whatever, is there a baseline we can provide that company with, look for these criteria or measure it in this way so that it would be a standard that would be recognized for future use?
What do you mean?
Does the state have any qualitative numbers that we should look for?
Pretty much, I would look at what your current quality of your water is right now.
Just what's in it, like mineral content?
That would be the best. Your water may not meet state water quality standards, so you should test what your water is there.
Okay.
But that's all.
How can we trust who Losing Valley's hiring?
Well, they have to hire a third party, an outside contractor. You get a copy of the report. You can dispute the report. And then we'd hire somebody else to verify it.
You do, or Losing Valley?
We would hire somebody else. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I think, talk about register or, evaluating your well, and I think unless you register your well, that doesn't hold any deal. You have to register that your well with the state.
Well, the law says it's a pre-existing water supply. It doesn't say if it's registered or not. Is it currently being used for water, is the way my regs read. It's different between a registered water supply. Mine says a use of water.
Does the permitting process also takes into consideration the property value of existing homes comparing to the 70s and 2010, right, 40 years, 30 years after? Who's going to, if they start mining, our property value is going to go way down. If we get an estimate, how much would they going to pay for this or compensate us?
There's no regulation in my purview to make
there's
that.
There's no consideration for that.
No. Okay. So, that was a quick overview of the coal program. It was very fast, very rough. I appreciate your questions. Just want to go to the maps real fast. I'm going to leave these maps here. I'll leave the presentation I have here on the paper for you guys to review. But just to give you an idea, Losing Valley's current plan, Moose Creek, is right here. Is that way? Currently, they're finding that the road is permitted over here. The prison is right in this area right here. They plan to put the whole road in along here. Operation comes in. They'll truck it out along the Glen Highway.
Russ, what mile is that they're going to tap into the highway today?
It's just past 55, between 55 and 56.
55 and 56.
Thank you.
How many trucks can we expect today?
It depends on how much their production is.
Based on the amount of coal that they have, that they're telling us they have, roughly how many trucks do that?
If they were at full production, it's 1.2 million. Rick, did you have that number?
They're planning 1.5.
1.5 million tons a day.
That would be a year.
I don't have that number off the top of my head. It won't be that hard to calculate.
Okay, are we talking 10 or 100? And then with these are pretty big trucks, so pretty heavy.
These are probably more like the dual rig, the double street trucks, dump trucks.
With the little trailer behind it? Or?
No, just a single pole in front.
Have they discussed doing a rail?
They looked at everything for access. They're still looking.
Just going to front trucks.
Right now, it's just truck.
So, are they going to pay for the repair of these roads because they're going to be damaging them?
Well, my jurisdiction ends at the public highway. It's
who can answer that question?
DOT.
Just so folks know, we did invite DOT and also DEC, and they weren't able to come tonight. So,
Do you know how wide that access road going to be? Because there's going to be some pretty big equipment going. They have to deliver the pretty good equipment to this mining site. So how do they? Did they give you a specific?
Well, typically, haul roads are designed. They have to give us a width. I think this road was designed to be 30 feet wide, 30 or 40 feet wide, for truck traffic. It's not haul road traffic. Actually, used to believe the haul roads are 60 to 70 feet wide to handle 100 ton trucks.
So that road, that trail then will be paved, right?
It'll be probably chip sealed all the way up.
In Chile, they do, they have two graders constantly grading it because they, for order to trucks to go out. So they, 24/7, the graders going back and
there's
forth.
There's a grader somewhere on the haul road when they're hauling trucks. They have a water truck on site at all times to control dust.
To control dust.
Yes.
Russell, the borough is in the process of doing a public process on a 60-acre parcel to allow access for the road. And it's a lease instead of an easement.
Right.
And in a meeting today with the manager, the question was asked, why 60 acres? He seemed to think it had something to do with SMACRA,
well, they
meaning
want,
a buffer.
The actual road itself plus a buffer around it for fishing based on data, have an area of access onto the road, pretty much a buffer to the site.
Yeah. Okay, but how big is that buffer?
It depends on where you are along the site. In some places, a quarter mile, other places, it can be 100 feet, 100 foot buffer.
What's a buffer? I mean, it's going to be flat?
Buffer is just basically you take the center line of your road, add the width of your road, a buffer would be the part outside of that road. That would be also included in your permit.
They're on their modification for their lease from the borough, they're asking to be able to use gravel. Will that gravel that they're taking stay within those lines, or where are they? Do you know where they're planning on getting that gravel from?
It depends on who their source is from the gravel. If they're taking gravel off site, it has to stay
off site.
Well, then it has to come back. Once they bought the gravel, they can use it where they want, but if it's within the permit area, it has to stay within the road prison of the basically constructed road. If it's gravel taken from on site, it needs to stay on the permit area.
I did some calculations.
You did?
It's not easy. At 1.5 million tons per year, that works out to about 4,100 tons per day, which would be, say, if it's 40 tons per truck, then that would be like 102 trucks per day. Or four per hour. But, you know, I mean, Houston Valley can barely produce 1.5 million tons per day from the coal mine Healy.
Yeah.
I have a hard time seeing ever.
That's the max. My session company are talking more like 500,000 tons.
But if it's 100 one way, then both ways, you're talking coming and going, right?
That'd be correct, yeah.
So
yeah.
That's like 200.
That's what it's going on.
And that's all the way to Point Pen.
I don't know where their loadout facility is.
I got a question.
Well, that's what they told us. So they're either going to go driven to Point McKenzie, Fort McKenzie, or rail to sewer.
I've talked to them, but they haven't really said much to me.
You know, it's kind of interesting that.
I got a question. In this permit process, how much land are they going to strip and have open to atmosphere at one time? Not planned.
I would need the permit in front of me. It would probably be 200-300 acres.
How many?
200-300.
200-300 acres. Now, the only other thing I have to say is, we get 100 mile an hour winds right from where that yellow thing is there, right across this whole country, about 100 miles for 6-7 days at a time. Mm-hmm. Are we going to end up with part of their cat in our yard or what?
If it's not loaded, we will.
Yes, you are.
Besides the dust and dirt and the coal dust. I mean, I literally 100 mile an hour winds for 5-6 days at a time.
You're right,
coming out of there.
I lost some metal roofing just the last time that they're blowing so hard.
Over 200 open acres?
That's 200 acres of disturbance. How much of that is actually open? I can't tell you without seeing the permit from you. but that's probably the max disturbance at any one time. That includes freshly cut material, material that's been freshly graded, to material that has topsoil and vegetation on it.
Just to round out his question there, so SMACRA, with as far as the permitting and air quality, what's the DNR jurisdiction for air quality? What's coming out of the mine?
Well, air quality for me, if there's dust from the mine being blown off, I can issue a violation on it because it's leaving the mine site. They're required to keep it on site. So if they have to decrease the acreage, increase the vegetation, cover faster, I can hit them on that. For issuing air permits, I don't have a way to issue an air permit.
Well, about September, I'm going to adopt you, and you can visit our
house. We're not much more than a half a mile from the site.
Well,
that'd
be good because his parents abandoned him
along. Rossi got the new home.
So, for Alice, had a question.
Okay, I'm just wondering here. We're talking about violations. Now, a violation is after the fact. And let's say, okay, the dust is, for example, blowing on us, and then you're called in and you say, okay, stop the dust. It's not that easy to do. What do we do about the effects prior to violations?
Well, that's one thing, that's why we're required to be there monthly. We're there on site all the time. Rain or shine, we're there. We go to Healy, it's 40 below, it's blowing 40, 50 mile an hour out of the canyon onto the mine site. We're on the ground hiking. In the summertime, rain, snow, mosquitoes, we're still hiking the perimeter, looking at the effects. If we see an issue on site, we work with the company to address the issue before it becomes a problem. If we recognize that dust is a major issue, there are things we can do to change how dust is controlled.
Have you talked to them about that yet? I mean, they're putting a mine in a known windy area, so you would think that there would be things that would have been discussed by now about how you're going to mitigate before anything even happens. And has that happened?
I have not had this conversation with them about this in this project.
And really? Like, as part of the permitting process? It's not required by SMACRA, I don't believe.
I will probably discuss
like
it when we get close to the activation going on with the mine, looking at this issue.
Russ.
It's a raised concern, we'll bring it up. There are fairly easy control measures to prevent dust on reclaimed soils. That can be windbreaks, other things that are very effective at lowering dust.
Isabelle plans to get 1.5 million production a year from this, but they're going to ship that coal to Korea, Japan, and maybe even to China if China's economy is still growing. How do you, as a DNR, address this problem, leaving us after 15 years with the barren land and shipping it out to the to foreign countries across the globe? Our resources that maybe 10, 15 years from now, we've had a technology, what the coal industry calling a clean coal technology, maybe 50 years down the road. We're going to end up with nothing here, just a damaged ecosystem and nothing else left. And all the coal go through the sewer terminal to the foreign entirety.
Well, I have said there's no control for me. They bought a lease from the state that says they can use the coal. They get a royalty off for it, they get taxes. A barren landscape, that will not happen. That's the reclamation standards, the requirements to reclaim it back to wildlife habitat. UCLA has 15-year plots out there where they're testing regrowth of willow and birch. So they're practicing the reclamation process already. They've been doing that ever since Idemitsu bought the property. Sorry, the process.
Many of us gardening, I'm sorry, just to follow up real quick, gardening on it over here, and we have to amend the soil, bring the topsoil, and amend it with the fertilizer every year, I mean even twice a year. How do they going to bring the topsoil to on that 200, 300, or 600 acres?
Well, they're required to salvage all topsoil that's on the site and re-spread it over the material. So, fertilizer for natural material is probably the worst thing you can do. It stunts the growth of natural vegetation. They use fertilizer for the first couple of years just to get cover crop on. But the working with the Plant Materials Center, their recommendations now is to stop fertilizing as soon as possible because it does inhibit natural growth.
So. There is
how long are you talking till, you know, this is back to a forest? You know, you're talking.
Well, reclamation is the process of going. Basically, remember, mining anticipates major disturbance. I'm not going to joke about that. It changes the water, it changes the surface. The part of this is reclamation, where reclamation is the process of restoring the land to some kind of function. Our permitting process looks at taking the land, getting it reclaimed to an area where the surface is stable, where we're not having water discharge that does not meet environmental quality standards. We have a vegetation succession that is modeled that at some point we'll return it back into a forest. They have to meet woody species, basically native woody species counts. They have to meet soil and leaf counts, understory counts for vegetation. It's all modeled in there before they start.
How long is it going to be in line before they restore it?
Yeah, like how long?
The bond clock on this mine is 5 years from the last disturbance. So
when they start.
Not when they start, no.
I want you to start about concurrent. Start talking about recurrent,
right.
Concurrent.
So one of the slides I left out, I don't have a cross-section to show you, is that basically mining is done in steps. Basically, your first initial step, you grub out an area, you strip off the overburden, take the coal, and then you spoil the material back into the pit. That material has to be pretty much graded out to some form that approximate the original contour. That's a requirement of law, approximate original contour. After that, any kind of topsoil that's salvaged is required to be put back on the slopes. Once all that's done, they're required to basically seed plant it with a species, native species, such that it will long, over the long term will reclaim back to a slope. Our 5-year clock does not count start until there's a stable layer of grass on the surface. So if it takes them 5 years, 10 years to get to that first step, the bond clock can be 5 years after that minimum. If it's at in the 5 years, it doesn't meet the requirements, we hold the money.
So in general, once the mine starts, and after they have the original cut and the pit begins to move, the original pit is backfilled and soil is placed on the top, and the revegetation starts right there. And so throughout the life of the mine, reclamation is taking place from virtually after the first several years.
Yeah.
So that as the mine progresses, reclamation is continually going on. And then after the last of the ore is taken out and the last is filled, the bond period goes on in various forms of release. There's like, how does the release go? Different standards are met with respect to the amount of vegetation, whether it's 10, 20, 30, 40, 50%, as the number of, literally people go out and count the number of stems of willows that are growing out of the ground per cubic meter, etc. People go out and count that, and as they achieve the successes that are spelled out in the plan and the standards, then slowly their bond comes back to them in little pieces.
Yeah, so we're not talking in our lifetime, we're not talking in these babies' lifetime, we're talking hundreds of years, because this mine is going on and on and on, and the longer they keep...
It doesn't have that long of a life.
Yeah. How do you remove...
How long?
Sorry.
There's multiple questions here.
Yeah.
The mine life is...
The mine life depends on their production. It. I think it's 25 million tons is on the is measured out there at 1.5 million tons. That's 15 years mine life for the site. At a lower production rate, it's much longer.
Can I get the?
There was a question back here.
Yeah, there was one back here.
How do you remove material from the ground? And what was it? 1.5 million tons? And not leave a hole. They're going to come up with material from someplace else.
When you disturb ground, there's something called swell. What happens is you break up the rock, you can never compact it as tightly as it was before. Okay, it's like digging a hole in your yard for a post. You can never get all the dirt back in the hole. Different soils have different percentages of swell. Okay, up in Healy, their soil swells. The dirt, once they blast it, move and dig it, is 30% at first. It settles down to 25% over a time frame. Here, don't know off the top of my head what the swell factor is for the dirt, but it's a mass balance equation. You move so much coal, if you have 100 foot overburden, 25 feet of coal, if your swell is 25%, you'll have zero loss in elevation. A lot of coal mines, they have too much spoil. They have basically swells higher than the amount of coal they're pulling out of the ground. They have too much dirt. And this is nationwide the issue. So the law actually spells out how to deal with that.
There was a gentleman over here who had
a
way back. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's obvious that most people here are against this, and rightfully so. But it's also obvious that at some point in the not too distant future, the rail belt from Seward to Fairbanks is going to be short on power. So what alternate suggestion other than coal do we have to fill the gap?
We have the in Alaska we have the hydropower, wind generation, wind solar generation we can tap into to replace this. Well, and replace it now. Okay. If we start doing it right now.
The Aleutian Islands is one of the windiest places in any American area. In fact, it's one of the windiest places in the world, and their wind production for generating power is 30% of the time. So, and I know for a fact there's two windmills down there that were blown over when the wind came, wasn't even at its maximum force. So wind power sounds great, it's totally impractical at 30%. That's maximum.
So I'm going to stop this discussion here. That needs to be taken after this meeting because we have guests here and we want to stay focused.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. Appreciate your comments.
And I can't add on to anything.
Yeah.
I can't do anything.
So we want to use their time really effectively. There was the cameraman.
And I'll add on to that. If there is interest in the energy discussion, I think it's in April, there's going to be an energy forum for mostly home energy efficiency and generation. Down at the depot, so you can find some of the discussion there. My question, though, for Russ, coming back to some of the water usage and the spoilage pits, or at least the settling ponds, I'm not sure the exact term. You mentioned the water being recycled and such. I think Isabelle has mentioned, I think it was in last year at the Sutton meeting, that they would potentially use some of that water to control dust on the road.
Right.
Is that in the permit, or have you had discussions?
That's commonly used to use pond water for road. That's something that's.
And my concern with that, and it sounded like a few other folks, was the if the water is being reused in the settling ponds, it sounds like that'll potentially concentrate some of the things like arsenic and selenium that they have, at least in the Healy coal. I don't know if that's here in our coal and Wishbone.
I looked at the chemistry, arsenic and selenium are not that high.
And are there other minerals or metals that are going to be of concern?
There's some metals in the spoil, but mostly there's selenium in some of the spoil material that has effect if it's used as a growing medium. The biggest issue is high SAR values, sodium absorption ratio values for the site. And that would have to be amended with something else to drop it off. And that's if it's being used as a growth medium. If it's used with underneath, it just needs to be protected for keeping water off of it.
And then if they use that, if they're spreading that water to control dust on the road, does that become an issue either for dust as it gets dried and blown off, or if it's a lot of water, does that turn into runoff that goes into to water waterways in the nearby area?
Generally, they take water from the decant side. Basically, they pull it out of the top of the decant, so it's already settled and cleared out. So specifically, if that water at the decant, the lower decant. Decant structure is a structure in a pond that allows you to discharge water. It's usually set up as your cleanest point of your pond. So that is where they usually pull water if they're pulling from the pond. If not, they'll pull another source. That usually has to meet water quality standards. So,
and is that something in your program that you monitor and such?
I monitor the water, DEC would monitor the quality. So they'd have to meet the water quality.
Gotcha. Thank you.
What do they do in the wintertime? Do they do water to keep the dust down all winter?
There's usually not a dust problem in the wintertime.
They have more dust problem in the wintertime up there than I do in the summer, with the winds blowing off the glacier.
There was this fellow here first.
Yes, question.
Go ahead.
The Rough Grouse Society, the Department of Fish and Game, has spent over $100,000 basically improving habitat or enhancing habitat for grouse and moose over there. A lot of you guys know the cuts over there. The large part of this project area is going to go right through the middle of that. Mm-hmm. Has there been any discussion of mitigating those funds and efforts expended by those outfits to do that? And now it's going to be basically...
At least not on my permit, there's no...
The other point is, too, and I haven't heard anybody talk about this yet, because the Moose Range is managed primarily for wildlife, at least the surface is, part of that is Fish and Game's obligation to provide public access for recreation, mm-hmm. not to just include moose hunting, but recreation in general. And it seems like, other than a couple of specific sites, specific trails and or roads, they're talking about obliterating all that with this project. And I'm just curious if anybody has addressed that at any other level at this point.
Well, I know it went through the original, when it first went through permitting, it had to address the Moose Range. Moose Range does talk about mining within the Moose Range, and coal is one of the issues in the Moose Range is as a resource. They do have to restore all the trails. If the area is for moose and grouse, that's their primary focus for reclamation on site.
On that note, then, you want to stay away from graminoids and grasses. Should come back to the woody vegetation.
Yeah, but generally, generally for reclamation, grasses are first. That's just a quick cover. But grasses are usually taken off after a while because it kills off, it stops everything else from going on site.
That's great. Okay. That's your
first, and then Bonnie's got you. Yep. I didn't.
Oh, I didn't see the other hand. Okay, Pete, why don't you go, and then.
Is there any other coal mines within a quarter mile where people live in Alaska?
Not in Alaska.
Now, is there a way to address the appropriateness of that in your permit?
Not in my permit. My permit spells out how to protect people living close to it. Yeah, it's very specific about that, and the rest talks about the environment on the side. That's more of a legislative issue, and it's out of my control.
I was just wondering if you're going to include access. I would suspect that there's regulation on location and potential spillage into local waterways, such as Moose Creek for settling ponds. If we could get access to that from the website.
For
regulation of the location of a settling pond.
The regulations for settling pond construction is on the website right now.
It's already there.
Yeah.
Okay.
And once the designs are up, the actual designs for the current designs for the settling ponds for this project are within the permit.
Okay.
So they'll be available also.
Do you know off the top of your head what the regulations are for how far those can be or how close they can be to an existing water body?
I
can look it up.
Yeah.
Hey, Russ.
Yes, sir.
When does the current permit run out?
Current permit runs out. Basically, it's eligible for renewal September 4th, 2011.
So the current one runs out in 2011.
Right.
Is it a foregone conclusion that the new permit will be issued?
The current law says that companies are guaranteed right of renewal once they start applying for it. They still have to go through the permit process, public notice process for it. If there's something that's basically out there, we can change the permit.
We can change the permit, but we can't stop the permit.
Well, you can change it enough so the permit's not economic anymore. If you find out something about the site that's different, bring it to our attention. It may change our permitting decision.
But that's a key point, I think, because this mine, the economics are tight on this mine. And they're looking for real specific conditions. So if there is a point in the permit that we can get changed and make it less economical for them to mine, that would be one way to stop the mine.
Can you give us any tips on how to do that? You work for us, right? Not the mine.
Bonnie first, and then the fellow in the green jacket.
Over at the... Chewitna mine, it says that it's estimated that over 200 ton of dust would blow across the storage facility each year. And it's because the requirement, it only requires certain areas to be covered. What are the requirements that you're asking them here for covering?
I'm not sure what you're talking about in the Chewitna permit. We don't have a permit plan for the control facilities right now.
Right. They're saying that the way the plan is right now, that just at the top that they're requiring that they have it covered, and but the storage amount, the tonnage that's on storage on site's not covered.
Right.
Are you requiring them to do any, I guess is what I'm asking.
We don't simply have to require a cover, but they do have to demonstrate that there is no dust coming off top of the pile. So if that requires them to lower the size of the pile, that's one thing. If it requires them to build a barn to put it in, because the wind's high enough, we can require that in the permit also. But
how many winds is high enough?
It's all based on modeling. It's if they have it in a hollow away from the wind, they can be pretty high wind before it affects. If it's up on a ridge bluff, it can be a really light wind and have the same effect. So it all depends on the permit.
What percentage of coal dust in the air right here would require, I mean, right now we have zero. What would be, do you have a certain number that you're looking at?
We don't have
at?
A certain number. And the amount of coal dust in this location right here is probably not zero.
Well, I mean, it's definitely zero compared to what it's going to be.
Well, how are you going to get a number? Like,
they have to do air modeling permits. They have to go through DEC air and model all sources of dust pollutants in the area. And that should give you the amount of dust that's being contributed from up in the valley in Richmond Hill. Cut exposures all over the valley where there's coal existing, where there's dust, will be part of that number. It'll look at combustion from this site, potential combustion from the project. That goes into the DEC air permit.
So yeah, should we be taking air quality tests all around here right now before they even start?
It's not even saying that they have been out already doing air monitoring.
That would be UC Valley?
Yes.
There's a guy at DEC, William Ashton, who's in charge of the air quality section there. He's a good contact for that kind of information.
What's his name again?
William Ashton.
Ashton.
So go ahead and then Gary will come in.
I'm Gary Olson. I live up on Murphy Road. I thought that we got this rid of in 2000, it seems to come back. So my question to you three gentlemen is, can you give me three things that will stop this, or is this in already?
The permit's been issued a long time ago. Where's the timeline?
Well, the permit was originally issued in 92 to Intermitsu. That company went through all the permitting and permitting requirements. It's changed hands twice. It was sold to Pacific Mining Company in 95.
That was an arm of Siri.
Right. And then in 96, Giustabelli took control of all the leases, 97, took control of all the leases and permit. Since then, Giustabelli has been very diligent about making sure their permit meets the requirements of the Act. So they've basically renewed their permit, required the monitoring they required, were required to do it, revised when we told them to revise the permit.
Shouldn't we be notified when
you have been notified?
Every one keeps changing to another one?
Every time, I have a list here of dates where we've done a action that required a public notice. So every time we do a permit transfer, every time we do a renewal, if we do a major revision, we do an expiration permit, that all requires public notice. I know my predecessor has been out here a couple of times talking about this. His predecessor has been out talking to the community about Wishbone Hill.
How is the public notified?
We are notified by direct mailing. We have a list of people who are concerned that we mail directly to. If you're not on that list, or you don't think you are, I'll leave my stack of cards here, email me, and I will put you on our database for everyone concerned with Wishbone Hill. And you'll get a letter every time there's an action. We also put it into the paper, we'll put it into the Anchorage Daily News, we'll put it into the Frontiersman, and then we'll put notices out on the state public notice website. And then we post in the local post office.
So we've got Dory first, and then Alice, and then Richie.
I was going back to your statement about once the dust leaves the site, then it becomes your jurisdiction.
Well, dust control, if I'm worried about off-site impacts. If it leaves the site, they're not meeting the requirements of the permit preventing off-site impacts. If it's on the site, they need to control dust because dust will affect other the regulation on the site.
Right, but then what I heard, because my hand went up before, we had a little discussion about setting the number, which really is going to go to Lane Hamilton for the DEC air quality, and that your jurisdiction is once it's on the land, not necessarily in the air.
Well, if there's dust, it comes back to the citizen's plate. If there is excessive dust, you think it's coal dust, or you see plumes of dust blowing at the mine site, you see leaving the site, that's where citizen's plate will come in.
Right, and but you will set a number that says, okay, cessation of work or cessation of operation if the dust is a certain level before this all gets going.
Well, I have looked into setting the number as compliance number. Then I'll be worked out with DEC if
right,
we did.
Right, that's
what
I think, okay, I just want to clarify.
Okay, Rob Barlow, when he spoke to us in April, he said, you will be impacted. And then I was in his office and he says, yes, you're all going to feel it. And this kind of scares me because when the coal company says, you're going to be impacted, you're probably really going to feel it. So my question to you is, can you guarantee us that there's going to be no long or short-term impacts on us or the wildlife, given that we have this permit?
I can't make that promise. Okay. I cannot say right here that there won't be some kind of impacts.
Okay.
They can be over there driving. Just knowing they're over there is an impact to you. I can't change that. Me being here is an impact to your life, so I can't change it.
Yeah,
it but my goal with the inspections and permitting is to minimize that impact as much as possible and mitigate the effects.
Okay.
So that means my blasting inspector is out here with a seismogram measuring the impact at your house at every shot. They'll be out here. If we have to do our own well investigations on your site, we'll be out here for them. If we need to do more inspections to make sure that they're on compliance at all times, we'll do that too.
Okay.
But I can't change that. It's going to be disturbed. You're going to know it's there. But I can tell you that we're going to be...
And the wildlife will know it's there too.
Well, wildlife's there, but my experience at Yosemite Valley, you got to chase the moose off to reclaimed areas. The moose don't go away. The grouse and the wolves, they stay right there. We've had that issue. They've had to chase beaver out of the ponds. The grouse are all over the site. So, this doesn't comfort you much, but the reclamation does work. We're preparing for a phase 3 bond release on part of the Use Berry stuff in Healy, and you cannot tell the difference between a reclaimed and a claimed fresh stuff. So, that's the only promise I can make you as a personal person, but there's going to be effects. I can't. Anything else for that?
Okay.
So my question was back to how they're getting the coal out of there. You said the permit's already released, so the road is the way they're going to do it. There's no way to change it or just tell them, you know, if 100 trucks a day is going to be driving down the road, we think that's too much. Well, they can't. When's the first time you can go back and adjust that permit to say, you know, do it by rail or do it a different way?
Well, my control is to the public part of the easement. The road, I can't control how much they produce. They have to permit for it. They have to show that they're in compliance for that production amount.
But for the part of the permit that they get out on the roads, and DOT has to be part of that, right?
Yeah.
I think what I was just saying is, you know, when you get to a public conveyance, like a public highway, our authority ends. And so really it's DOT is going to probably make the decisions on all the traffic issues.
I've been to other states where they've had the trucks going from one permit, crossing a state highway, going along a state highway back in. The mine was required by DOT to have street sweepers running behind every single truck. So
DOT's already signed off on this?
DOT is still looking, they've been in discussion with DOT, but I'm not privy to what they've talked about.
So. Have any of you guys ever had anybody in your family die from black mold?
No.
We have. Do you understand our concern at all?
Of course.
At all?
Of course.
I
somewhat in regards to Bonnie's concern, and also with the plethora of different agencies that follow different parts of this project and permits. What we've heard from Usabelli and some of the folks who are in favor of the mine is that it'll be a plus for economic development for the area. Who looks at the total costs to a community for a coal mine? Who quantifies that impact of coal trucks rolling down the road, of coal dust, of whether it's the reverberations from blasting? Who quantifies the amount of carbon that's put in the air that turns into ocean acidification, that drops our fish catch down? Who quantifies that?
That's way beyond my pay grade. I don't know. I don't have an easy answer for you because that's a hard question.
Yeah, and that's what we're dealing with. Yeah. You know.
Michelle, yeah, I'm going to take a couple seconds. You talked about the permitting process. Things you looked at, data to get a permit. One of the things you mentioned was land use in the area. Mm-hmm. Land use in the area has changed dramatically since the 80s. This was a few homesteads. Now this is a big neighborhood with several hundred thousand residents. Doesn't that require a permit? The fact that the land use in the area has changed markedly since the original permit, and rather than arbitrarily renew it, go back and take a look at how much has changed.
Well, the land use only affects the disturbance area. They look at the land use around the site because it tells them what they're going to impact.
They don't factor.
Well, that's their economics, but it does play in their economics because they now everyone's close by, they got to start paying for surveys, and they have to start mitigating. Basically legal defense against them. But for the permit site, they've factored in saying it's all wildlife use out there, or private property, designed for...
So your permit process doesn't actually factor in what's a quarter mile away?
Except the environmental impacts to it. Do they have they addressed the effects of blasting, or the eject of water? Does their hydrogeology and water modeling predict what's on off-site? So it's a changing community next door. Again, that goes back to Tim's question. That goes to a legislative question, which.
So it's already 7:30, and it's how many more questions are out there? Brian, are there, Dory? Okay, so anybody else?
I actually have just one.
Okay, all right, Andre first.
Folks, I would like to, couple words about this is not a done deal with that mine going in. We can make a change and make a difference here. I would encourage everybody to sign up the petition today before you leave if you don't want that mine to go in. And another point that I wanted to make, I want to quote it from the Usabelli website about the environment impact and reclamation. And reclamation is a challenge due to the lack of topsoil on the north-facing slopes, deep permafrost layers, abbreviated field season. Best time to regrading is between September through December, and the high rate of naturally occurring erosions. The spring and summer season bring quick-moving rainstorms with abundant rainfall, which challenge soil stability, especially on 3-to-1 slopes. That's reclamation is a dismal record for the company. And one more point, sir, for you, that coal that's going to mine, it's not going to be used for heat our homes or do the energy. It's going to go across the oceans to China, Korea, and as an export to other entities. Thank you.
Yeah. We will get the main part of it back.
7%
in the form of mercury and acid gray.
So,
very
Brian?
If we somehow can talk Usabelli into not mining this claim, is there any way DNR would remove this area from coal mining or give them back money for their leases?
I don't know. There are legal, vast legal issues involved with what would be called a taking. I can't address them.
Would they have to go through legislature?
I'm not being a lawyer, I don't know how that would go, actually.
Have you ever suggested letting the public lease the land?
I don't know why such arrangements can't be made. I mean, we have land transfers, swaps, things like that all the time.
I mean, if all the communities got together, Palmer, Wasilla, everybody got together, and we just leased that part from you?
Sorry, the land section. The land section would have to address that.
So, Pete? Pete?
Yeah, if there's a citizen complaint and you have to come out and investigate it, do they have to stop before and while you're doing that investigation, or do they just carry along and keep making that problem?
It depends what the problem is.
So if dust is blowing off-site, and we say, hey, there's dust blowing off-site, get up here, do they have to stop?
Well, I have to verify that it's going on.
Well, yeah, but before they get here, before you get here, there could be a lot more dust blowing off-site.
It's all relative to what it is. I can't say yes or no that if you see dust, I'm going to stop the site. I will say that I will be out here trying to stop, trying to find a way to fix it.
I mean, such things do happen. You know, sometimes a complaint, if it sounds like a serious safety violation, for instance, of life or limb, sometimes an inspector can make a decision for the mine to cease operations until the inspector gets there. That does happen.
So if we see rises in, say, mercury on our property, are they responsible to come and clean up that mess, or do they just have to pay a $5,000 fine?
Most of the mercury issues related to coal are not related to the mining of coal, it's related to the burning of coal.
Well, okay, see what I'm getting at. If chemicals from their mine,
Wait, let me rephrase it.
Their mine lands on our property.
If there's an impact to your property from the mine that's directly related, on top of the fine they're going to receive, on top of the violation, they're responsible for fixing that off-site impact.
It's
an off-site impact directly related to the mine. I don't care how far it goes. If it's directly related, it's more risk.
And what is the threshold then for that toxicity on our land? I mean, I don't want any. How much is it?
Toxicity is the question we even don't have.
So you must have a threshold about what you allow them to allow off their site before they have to remediate it.
Well, there's no dust off the site. That's
no dust at all, okay.
I mean, that's... No, there's mitigate the amount of dust coming off the site is what we're looking for. And minimize the impacts.
So I think it was Dory and then Kathleen.
I sort of wanted to shift a little to the EPA guy because you actually do are concerned with air, which to me is a big issue here. At what point in time does EPA step in this process in terms of our air quality and other? Well, I understand you also have a problem what your specific is, but because I know in some instances EPA has a higher standard or a more restrictive standard.
And one second, Dory was asking, when does EPA step in? At what stage? So.
Okay. Yeah, I'd be happy to address that. Are you
tired? I'm done asking questions with
them. You're doing a great job of attracting all of the parts there. And it's really appropriate that Russell's been hogging up all the presentation time because the coal program is a state program. And when the federal Congress passed, SMACRA initially, as Russell mentioned, they provided the opportunity for states to take over the program because it was felt that states running the program, states were closer to the public and more responsive to the public. And you can decide for yourself whether that's the case, but lots of federal environmental statutes were set up that way. The Clean Water Act is set up that way. I'm sure many of you are familiar with the fact that DEC has taken primacy of the 402, the National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System program, so they've done that as well. But, Congress intended SMACRA to be a comprehensive statute so as to avoid a patchwork of regulatory agencies all providing different messages both to the public and to a mining company. Be that as it may, there are still applicable other statutes. So EPA, as you mentioned, does have an air quality program. However, DEC does have the principal responsibility for managing here. So I'm not sure whether or not EPA would ever get involved with air from this issue. Our air program addresses things like flaring from oil and gas operations, and we're heavily involved in that. But I don't think that we have any involvement at usability in terms of air. Under the Clean Water Act, there's two sections where we are active. Section 404 is the program that I work in. That's a program that's actually run on a day-to-day basis by the Corps of Engineers. And they're not here tonight, so I'll speak for them, because when I speak for them, they say what I like to hear. They don't always say what I like to hear, but they speak for themselves. But, Matt LaCroix. the 404 program under the Clean Water Act addresses discharge of fill to waters of the U.S. So Moose Creek's a water of the U.S., Balto Creek's a water of the U.S. A week and a half ago, Ben Soyseth, who's a core project manager in the Wasilla office off of Czech Street, off of Kanikus Bay, and I were looking at some of the delineations of the lease area to identify whether or not wetlands that are within the lease area are connected to the surface waters and our waters of the U.S. If they are, then any impacts to those sites are regulated by the Clean Water Act. So the Corps and EPA will be looking at that. We're just, at this point, starting to look at the plan of operations for site disturbance to determine whether or not there will be a federal permit from the Corps required for that. Section 402 of the Clean Water Act, that was the section that established the National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System. And that's the program that DEC is taking over. So they're responsible for stormwater at this point and seafood and some other things. EPA still has a role in discharges to waters of the U.S. That's the case in usability now. They actually have discharge authorizations they received from the EPA for excess water. And I don't think that there's any proposal at this point for direct discharges, but I'm not familiar with that plan of operations. So
okay, add into this.
Yeah.
Currently, our permit shows that the 404 permit is currently pending for review by Corps of Engineers. The 402 permit for MPDS, stormwater, wastewater, that's all pending also, pending review by whoever is the privacy agency.
Yeah, so our 402 folks, which are primarily based out of Seattle, we've got some people in Anchorage, mm-hmm. and DEC are working on that together. My assumption is that DEC will be the lead on that, but I think that they're looking at stormwater non-point source as opposed to any direct discharge, from a pipe saying this is excess water and we're gonna dump it in Moose Creek. That's something that would never be allowed.
I talked to Alan Nakanishi with DEC, and they've not received any permits or they've had some initial discussions with usability, but nothing else beyond that.
Right. So our involvement, my involvement personally is pretty limited. But as an agency, EPA is very concerned about coal mining operations and possible effects on the environment. There was a lawsuit filed this morning against EPA by a coal mining company because we revoked their 404 permit. Of course, you know, a permit actually.
West Virginia.
Actually, 3 years ago they issued that permit, and the EPA has been looking at environmental effects, principally from mountaintop mining. The agency put a hold on 81 different permits, and in fact, revoked this one. So there's a lot of concern. There's a lot of political pressure. So there's a lawsuit filed today. A lot of things going on. That's mostly an East Coast and Appalachian issue. But
it has bigger. It has larger.
It has larger ramifications. Absolutely. We will be feeling it even on this coast as well. There were also last week there were new regulations, proposed EPA regulations for discharges from mine sites. So that wouldn't affect an operation that is not proposing to discharge, but off-site. But the proposal is to increase, or decrease actually, the thresholds for discharge waters, and for the first time look at specific conductance as a measured species. So in terms of air, I don't think we would have any nexus here, certainly in terms of potential impacts to the surface waters and the wetlands. Yes, and right now we're trying to evaluate which of the wetlands are jurisdictional to the federal government. Everything is jurisdictional to the state, but the federal government does have some limits. And I know that our wastewater and stormwater folks are working with DEC on that. So under the state's SMACRA Act, you didn't mention this, but I'm guessing that most people in the room here are aware that in order to take primacy of that program, the state had to pass its own statute that met minimum federal requirements. So the federal statute was basically the template. The state had to develop a statute of its own and a program in order to take that over. And that statute is available, so folks can take a look and see that. In fact, I suspect probably many of you already have.
Yeah, the OSM, as they change the federal laws continuously, we have to change ours to meet those standards.
Right. So I don't know if there's any questions specifically for me. We do have a small role, but like you said, as an agency, looking at this issue nationally, we have documented lots of long-term environmental impacts, and we have great concern about that. It's a very contentious issue because there's a lot of coal that this country has, and so there's a lot of political pressure to develop that coal and to make it happen. At the same time, a lot of that coal is very proximal to where people live.
So is the violation you referred to a 404 violation?
Like a 402.
It's a 402. Yeah. So it was a discharge issue that they have. And can you just give us a little bit information on that?
I don't really have any details on that, but information on our violations is available on our website and national website, and I can make that information and the case number and everything available to folks, so it can be passed along and you can take a look at it. So.
I know that this is probably a little bit out of scope of what everybody's concern is, but I actually have a concern. And that is, a lot of us have probably built new homes up here. I stopped counting at 25 new homes, and we put ours in place and moved into it in 2004. And I stopped counting at 25, and since then at least 25 more homes have been built up here. So the population has truly increased since the beginning of the permitting process. But all of us have built homes and developed our land to the tune, in some cases, of $500,000 or more. And it wasn't easy, because it's not easy up kind of in the wilderness to do this kind of stuff. And I know it was only briefly brought up about the value of the land after this all happens. So, and you said that there was nothing, there is no recourse other than probably a mass suit against usability. When you go to try to sell your land and you discover that it's only, maybe you can sell it for half or less than what you ever even paid for it, let alone any value of the increase. So that's my concern that follows with the birds singing, the quietness, the beauty in the area, the moose laying in our yard or kneeling down in our yard eating the grass. We live with them, you walk outside, take pictures, and they move off, but they don't attack. And that's going to be all disturbed by sound, huge sounds. How many times a day are they actually going to blast?
At night.
And at night, too. And at night. And from your map, our house can't be much more than a half to three quarters of a mile from the actual site.
Or less. It's a quarter mile. Basically, my house to where this first pit's going is a quarter mile.
So that, having moved up here from a very noisy area anyway, and finding that dead silence at night was beautiful. So that's my major concern, is an awful lot of us around here have done just exactly that, built these beautiful houses. You know, I've seen people build them for their mothers that have moved up here and done everything that they could to... It's a beautiful place, actually. So my major concern is the fact that that mining is going to last 40 to 50 years, not 5 years. And as they fill in the little hole, there's still a bigger hole going in somewhere else, so each of them. And I was through Butte, Montana. That coal mine there is awful. But that was before the laws went into effect. You can. I know you have nothing to say.
Yeah, I don't know if you guys know me. I'm Dr. Benedetti. I work at the hospital. I'm chief of the medical staff of the hospital. And while you guys are all reading books and magazines, I'm reading medical journals. And what I've read in medical journals is that an open pit mine is a public health hazard. There's no other way to define it.
Absolutely.
Which is why you guys have a journal, because it is such a hazard to people. Not just the moose, and not to the roads, and not to our property values, but to the people who live there, to my neighbors. This is a known public health risk, and it seems to me negligent to knowingly dig Love Canal in a neighborhood. That, to me, on the surface, is just negligent to even let it happen, to build a known public health risk in a neighborhood. This isn't human, this is a neighborhood. And there's no other way to define this mind except a public health risk.
If I could just piggyback, I think the only way we're going to make these arguments like yours and our property values and our quality of life is through our legislature and the government. We are not going to make, these guys are doing their job.
Yeah.
They're saluting and they're executing the rules that are issued for them. If we want to change the rules and make an impact on what's going on up here, our legislature is going to have to get involved. And I don't think we're going to make a dent any other way.
And if I may say so, they were invited to this meeting tonight. So if they're not here,
we'll
need to email them and ask them why.
The legislature is a bell.
There is a bell.
Local legislators, City Hall for Palmer and Wesola, Carl Gotcho, a whole list of them.
John Harris.
They are pretty busy right now, you know.
So I'm gonna stop us here. Just, and if you have extra questions for these folks, can you guys stay around for just a little
sure.
bit afterwards? We've already been in here for 2 hours, and I think this is a good place to pause. So I want to thank you all for coming. And before you all leave, if this is something you are interested in, please give us your name, give us your email. There is a committee of neighbors that is working together. We would love to have your voice included. Stop and visit with Kirby. He'll take your name.
I'll take emails, names and emails on your way out. If you want to write it out and hand it to me on your way out, I'll compile a list.
And there's a bumper sticker on the shelf there.
And there's one other thing. There are things happening right now, and I just wanted, Kathy Wells is going to just explain to us what's happening on Monday, next Monday.
Okay, I mentioned earlier that the borough has a lease that's tied to this of 60 acres where the access road
is. Hang on, you guys. Come on up here.
Where the access road is going to go through, and that's something that you should think about weighing in on. The Real Property Asset Management Board is meeting at the borough next Monday at 5 p.m. They're one of the advisory boards that things like this go through, and then it's supposed to work its way on up. Through the PC and the Assembly, of which Mr. Arvin and Lynn Woods are here tonight. And you know, this is something that definitely could affect their operation. If they don't have access and can't build a road, then you probably won't get a mine. And so I would encourage you to go to this meeting and give your input and start lobbying the local government.
It, just so you know, I talked to Usability today. They're talking about putting a road in this summer to start bringing some drilling equipment up there and doing more testing. So we may see that road going in.
They're surveying for it, started a couple days ago.
Yeah.
And by the way, they're calling it a trail.
Yeah.
Exploration trail. Let's examine the noise factor, too. Through the burrows.
I want to thank the gentleman for coming tonight.
Yes, so I want to thank DNR and thank Matt LaCroix. So thank you, Russell. Thank you, Rick, so much for being here. And thank you, everybody else, for coming out.
Thank you, Joe.
Stay in contact.
You guys feel beautiful to look too.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, so is yours. And thanks for your comments, Kathleen. Really.
Were they wrong?
Not at all. They're wonderful. Thank you.